Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The U.S. topped 5 million confirmed coronavirus cases over the weekend, and more than 160,000 people have died from the virus. A new report also shows that nearly 100,000 kids tested positive in the last 2 weeks of July. These numbers come as schools and universities reopen throughout the country. And for more on all of this, we have with us Dr. Rochelle Walensky, chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. 5 million confirmed cases. That's astounding. But how accurate are these numbers when we know that states like California and Florida are discovering glitches to their databases that make their numbers inaccurate? Could the cases actually be higher?
I think the numbers could be much higher for so many reasons. First of all, you know, let's just pause and say 5 million cases. Those are 5 million cases we know about. The CDC estimates that that could be 10% of the total. That is for many different challenges. One is people are asymptomatic, of course, but another is that we haven't been testing enough. So 5 million cases is astounding. We've reached 5 million from 4 million in just 17 days. I think more astounding than the 5 million cases is the over 160,000 deaths. I mean, when you just think about the sheer volume of that number, we're at death rates of over 1,000 a day daily. And I think that the death toll here is truly astounding.
Yes. Can we talk about the accuracy of the numbers that we're receiving and possibly some of the reasons why there are so many problems? Florida and California are having these data collection problems. Why are these states failing with their data collection? And can we trust data from other states?
You know, like so many things that have not been centralized in this pandemic, data collection is yet another one. It's kept to the local authorities. I think volume has been a huge problem. So how do we standardly collect the data? How can we look at the data across states? How do we account for data delays? And then finally, how do we report death data? And so these are all sort of really tricky ways to sort of try and compile the data and make it comparable across states. There hasn't been federal direction in order to be able to do that. And some of these states are just simply overwhelmed.
And we know that several states, including Virginia and Ohio and Louisiana, are banding together to bring that uniformity that you're talking about. I want to ask you about this report, though, on kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. 100,000 kids infected in 2 weeks in July. Children still make up fewer than 10% of confirmed cases, but the rate of infections in kids is outpacing Americans overall, and I want to know, how big of a threat is that for schools that are reopening right now?
Yeah, this is a really interesting space. You know, when we talk about kids in other areas of infection and pandemics, flu to begin with, kids were really thought to be a major vector. In this pandemic, kids have been less implicated as being the initial case in a household. The challenging news with 100,000 kids is, wow, that's just a lot of kids. And so even if you have a 0.2% fatality rate, which is really quite low, you're still talking about 200 fatalities. When you talk about what it implies for opening schools, we know that in places that have been able to open schools successfully, the community spread, the amount of disease is around 1 per 100,000. And when you hear about these cases in, for example, Georgia that has been on the news, that county, Paulding County, where the school closed, had case rates of around 21 per 100,000. So that's 20-fold higher than one might have expected in places that have done this successfully.
My last question for you, Dr. Walensky, going back to our conversation about bad data. Last week, I spoke with Ohio Governor Mike DeWine after he got what appears to be a false positive from an antigen test. And these are the rapid tests that the White House has been using for people who are around President Trump. The White House now wants to ramp up production of these tests to 20 million a month. Is that enough? And will we really be able to rely on the results of this kind of testing?
It's a really good question, and one I think that the public needs to understand. The test that we do in the hospital to diagnose a patient in an ICU coming into the emergency room need to be very sensitive. The tests that we need for the community to understand whether somebody is infectious, the antigen tests are doing quite well. Now, what happened with the governor with regard to whether that was a false positive or a true positive, that really needs to be teased apart, but with different kinds of tests and different testing strategies. But I do believe that the antigen tests have a really important role for a public health intervention to understand whether people are infectious today.
That's Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Tanya.
Well, to Hong Kong now, which today used its new national security law to make a high-profile arrest of Jimmy Lai, a prominent pro-democracy voice and a supporter of the protests that erupted in Hong Kong last year when the law was proposed by China. Critics said it was designed to crack down on dissent. Beijing says it's for national security. But the police action today at Lai's office marked the first time the new law has been used against the media. CNN international reporter Will Ripley joins us from Hong Kong on Skype. Will, this was very public. Describe what happened today.
These were the kind of scenes that we're used to seeing in developing countries, a huge swarm of police officers walking into the newsroom of Apple Daily, the newspaper owned by Jimmy Lai, a media tycoon, a billionaire, and an outspoken critic of Beijing. And it was surreal to watch officers in a newsroom where there are reporters that are doing stories about them and the government, checking IDs, going through evidence, all because Jimmy Lai is being charged under this new national security law. And basically, he's kind of on a list of people, of activists who are deemed problematic, which are probably a big reason why Beijing pushed so hard to get this law passed in the first place.
Well, and this arrest came just a couple days after Chinese and Hong Kong officials were said to, you know, media reports said that they, you know, were shrugging off new sanctions that were imposed by the U.S. But also today, China announced unspecified sanctions against 11 U.S. politicians and heads of organizations promoting democratic causes. This is including Senators Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. There's a little back and forth going on there. Did this arrest, the timing of this arrest, have anything to do with those sanctions?
We don't know if the timing is connected to the sanctions, but yes, I mean, this arrest comes as tensions between the U.S. and China over this national security law have been escalating. And there's these back and forth sanctions, you know, the U.S. accusing Hong Kong officials of undermining the city's autonomy. And now you have something that a lot of foreign news organizations were afraid of. You know, a month or two ago, nobody would have imagined that in Hong Kong, media organizations would be raided by police like this. And it just goes to show that the freedom of the press, just like freedom of speech, is now no longer a part of life here, at least for people who hold a view that Beijing, the central government, does not agree with.
Well, if China and its officials in Hong Kong believed that this was going to maybe, you know, put a dent in the pro-democracy movement, wouldn't the opposite be true? Or do you think people will be cowed by this?
I can only tell you, based on observations this year over last year, first of all, the protests have all but evaporated. Now, a large reason for that is the pandemic and the fact that currently you can't gather in groups larger than two if you leave your home here in Hong Kong. So some are saying that the government is conveniently using the timing of the pandemic to accomplish the elimination of the protest movement, and also, by the way, postponing the legislative council elections that were supposed to happen, you know, until next year. They were supposed to happen next month. And that is huge because as they postpone the elections, they're also disqualifying candidates with pro-democracy viewpoints. They've already disqualified at least a dozen. And these are people that were doing well in the polls that were expected to beat and take seats from the pro-Beijing parties. So you have the pandemic combined with this national security law that has effectively ended protests. You have essentially now people who are so scared that they're deleting their social media accounts because the law isn't supposed to be retroactive. But if police arrest you for an offense that you commit today, they can then go through your phone and your Facebook and your Twitter and your Instagram and whatever other social media you have and look for any evidence going back years that you had some sort of a viewpoint that, you know, is deemed to be a national security threat for mainland China. It seems as if nobody is safe if they touch any aspect of this pro-independence or pro-democracy movement, even if it's covering it as a journalist.
Well, meanwhile, Hong Kong police are saying they arrested 10 people in what they call this national security operation. Media mogul Jimmy Lai and other senior executives, ages ranging from 23 to 72 years old. What's expected to happen to them?
Imagine being 23 years old and you're facing maybe 3 years, maybe 10 years, heck, maybe life in prison. But there's also the possibility of a trial without a jury. Some people could be taken to the mainland for trial. So these people who are activists are having to weigh the very real possibility of a huge chunk of their life and their freedom evaporating by what they're doing. And you still have some people who are willing to take that risk. Obviously, Jimmy Lai, a billionaire with huge assets financially and legally, he's willing to try to fight this. But at the end of the day, you're no longer talking about the rule of law that Hong Kong has been accustomed to for all of these years. This is a new rule of law that is much more in alignment with the mainland. And that's why the U.S. is saying there is no longer autonomy, that Hong Kong no longer operates with a high degree of autonomy.
CNN international correspondent Will Ripley in Hong Kong. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
In this moment of racial reckoning, many white Americans are asking, what part did I play? Ed Ball began that soul searching about 30 years ago. He has a new book out now, Life of a Klansman. It's a history of a murderous post-Civil War white supremacist in his family. But today we want to look at the book he started in 1993 and took 6 years to write and research, Slaves in the Family. It's one man's apology for his family's participation in the slave trade and a takedown of the family myth that they were the good slave owners in rice plantations along the Cooper River in South Carolina's Low Country. After the book came out in 1998, Ed Ball felt he needed more than an accounting. He needed to make an apology, and he needed to bring together the white and black descendants of the Ball plantations. I was privileged to travel with him for a story for ABC's Good Morning America for this reckoning that started in one of the family's former plantations.
When I look at parts of this former plantation, I see a beautiful, spacious lawn. You see what?
I see the slave village, because that lawn was the site of 12 slave houses where about 150 people lived.
Finding the Ball slave descendants was hard. Earning their trust was harder.
I was very skeptical. Didn't trust them.
That's Charlotte Dunn. She's Katie Rogers' daughter. Katie's grandmother was the Ball family slave Bright Ma. Ed found her name in South Carolina Historical Society records. Katie remembers Bright Ma jumping into a river.
And I said, why you do that? She said, I want to show you what I had done to keep from getting a whipping. I said, they was going to whip you? She said, oh, yeah, they would have whipped me good.
When he apologized, that was symbolic of the acknowledgement that I needed and other black people needed of the atrocities that happened in our lives.
Charlotte appreciated Ed's apology. Ed's white relatives, like Jeff Ball, did not.
I'm not accountable for something that happened 167 years ago.
And then there was this caller to a local radio show.
His family profited from the slavery of my people, and he owes more than a book. I wish he would come to me and tell me, yeah, my people, you were my slaves in my family. I would beat the crap out of them myself.
And it was in this climate that Ed Ball organized his black and white descendants reunion. So what happened? And what advice does Ed Ball have today for families also willing to turn a clear eye to their ancestors' history? Ed Ball, author of The New Life of a Klansman and the National Book Award-winning Slaves in the Family, joins us now. Ed, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You know, after so many years, what happens when you hear again about that trip years ago?
Well, it is a journey of acknowledgement and of redemption. African Americans and white Americans who share a violent and warlike history can break bread together in a way that fosters healing. And that's what I feel about what we did some 25 years ago.
Well, you say you hope for healing, and I saw some. And others may be suspicious that this was, you know, a white person wanting to assuage their own guilt and asking the
you know, the African Americans to help him do that. Or some romantic notion maybe that you once again would be the white person coming in to, you know, kind of heal them.
Well, some people didn't want to talk to me at all. Most people were quite suspicious. But after spending months at the kitchen tables of dozens and dozens of African-American families, I mean, my family enslaved close to 4,000 people, and there are approximately 100,000 descendants. I managed to build genuine relationships. I did come to the conclusion that it was appropriate to apologize. Inadequate, perhaps even somewhat self-serving, but a symbolic act of atonement and acknowledgement that my people had perpetrated acts of violence and cruelty on the bodies of thousands of others. And I still think this is part of the undertaking we're having right now, which is to change the narrative about American memory and American history.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the moment where you have brought together your relatives and the descendants of the people they enslaved. You didn't think anyone would show. Hundreds came with great trepidation. We're going to start with one of the black descendants, Dolores Singletary.
I was a little nervous this evening. It was thinking about Edward's family and wondering, well, we are not sure just how receptive they are.
Hello, hello.
They would meet, but first they would listen. They heard about the whippings, about the slave children born of slave owners. And after Ed spoke, he asked the descendants of slaves to stand.
Show yourselves.
Then the descendants of the slave owners. Then Ed introduced his white relatives to his new black acquaintances.
Nellie, may I introduce you to Dolores Singletary?
Yes. Hi.
How are you?
Nellie Ball Brennan.
I sort of look at it as an accountability. That's kind of how I see it. We're just sort of claiming the past and being accountable to it.
Well, I'm glad to meet you.
Yeah, I'm glad to meet you.
Now, you read about some of the books.
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad you want to meet me.
So, Ed Ball, there we have one of your white relatives saying, I'm glad you want to meet me.
Yes.
It was quite a day.
A lot of my relatives were scared. Some were concerned that if I wrote an uncensored history of our family slave plantations, we would be shamed and vilified. And more than a few worried that we might be sued for reparations. However, in the end, terrible things did not occur and do not occur to white families that undertake to reckon with their inheritance. And I've been contacted by hundreds upon hundreds of African Americans who are interested in doing something like this from the other side. So I think that there is a kernel of medicine by this family-to-family personal reckoning with our historical past.
You mentioned the fear of being sued for reparations. There is no Ball family money. It was all lost after the Civil War. You, at the time, I remember you were trying to think of maybe something you could do with the sale of the book.
I undertook a personal project of reparations. I established a small foundation. It was called the Committee of Descendants, and it brought together three black descendants of Ball family slaves and three white members of the Ball family, and we distributed small grants in South Carolina as an act of repair.
Well, and as others have said, it's something that the entire country needs to participate in. Ed Ball, just asking you briefly about your new book, Life of a Klansman. I guess you were looking through your mom's papers in 2003, and you found this reference to our Klansman. The book is getting beautiful reviews. You spoke with Lulu Garcia Navarro on NPR. We'll post that at herenow.org. You did a bookstore appearance with Ibram Kendi, the anti-racist scholar, supporter of your work. You were supposed to speak at Tulane, and that was canceled after students fiercely objected to the notion of a white person speaking about a white supremacist family history. What would you say to those students?
I would say that I honor your sense of injury, and yet I disagree that those stories should be silenced. It's a bit like lancing into an old wound that has healed over and trapped poison within it. And I think that by opening the wounds that we have in our national memory, and we have quite a number of them, and releasing the poison, we might be able to heal our injuries more successfully.
Well, and it's an injury you walk with. You'd never compare it to that of the descendants of the slaves on your family's plantations, but you write in your book, you are well aware that this Klansman's rampage cleared space for the comfort that you and all whites live in right now. And that makes you sick at the stomach, you write.
Now and then, while researching and writing, I did have to pause because some of the stories are like hot stones held in the hand. But this is, again, trying to get to the other side of it by passing through it.
Author Edward Ball, again, his new book, Life of a Klansman. We've also been speaking about his 1998 National Book Award-winning book, Slaves in the Family. Ed Ball, thank you so much. It's so nice to speak with you again. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Robin. It's good to be with you.
And in that 1998 reunion, one of the white Ball relatives gave a wooden peg she'd taken from the slave quarters before they were demolished to black descendant Dolores Singletary. We leave you with her thoughts as she held that piece of wood.
It was a home that they lived in. Something tangible that you actually can touch. These were real people. They were human. They had feelings.
Your ancestors.
Yes, my ancestors were real.
The White House is willing to compromise. That's what Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin told CNBC this morning, saying the White House could strike a deal with Democrats on a new coronavirus relief package. You remember negotiations broke down last week. President Trump stepped in and issued a handful of executive actions offering an additional $400 a week to the unemployed, deferring payroll taxes for a while. But is that even legal, and who pays for it? Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Jill, start with the extra unemployment. The Republicans wanted it down to 200. They said that too much money was keeping people from going back to work. Democrats wanted to keep the extra 600 that's been going on for months. Here comes the president with 400. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, if it were 400 and there was some certainty and this was congressional action, we might feel better about it. Again, it's really legally questionable what the president is doing. And clearly what I think is really what we're trying to get to is that there are millions of Americans, 30 million, who are receiving some form of unemployment assistance. And those people who now have to look in the eye of their own budgets and say, how am I going to survive? They need relief and they need some certitude about when this is going to happen. And I understand that there is a lot of consternation around the money that was being paid, the $600 that many people were earning more on unemployment than off. I just want to reiterate, I know you've said it on the show a lot of times, that there is absolute debunking of this notion. Papers from Yale University, Chicago Fed, there's no correlation between receiving larger benefits and looking for a job. So I think that the 600 number surely would be better, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, people might have anecdotes here and there, someone that can't get to come back to work because they like that extra 600. But overall, people need this money. And, you know, when you say whether it's legal, Congress is supposed to appropriate funds. This $400, the extra, some of it would come from the Congress, but some of it would come from the states. And what are the states saying about whether or not they can do this?
Well, again, this is a really weird quirk here, because what the president has done is said the federal government will kick in $300 a week. That would be occurring because they would be siphoning off aid from disaster relief. So, gosh, if there's a hurricane or a brush fire, we're in big trouble. So $300 would come from the feds. The states would have to opt in and provide $100 a week. This is a brand new program, never been done before. And so many states are under budgetary pressures already. I'm not sure they have the money to do this. It would be a terrible thing for a state to have to say, should I do testing and tracing, or should I give $100 a week in extra benefits for unemployment?
Jill, we only have a minute here, but this idea of deferring the payroll tax, this is the money deducted from paychecks that goes into Social Security and other accounts. You know, people are just realizing it might be deferred now, but they have to pay it down the road, maybe a bigger piece. You know, just in the few seconds we have, your thoughts on that deferment.
I think it's silly. I mean, look, this is sort of like the income tax date moving from April to July. Just because it moved to July doesn't mean you don't have to pay your taxes. And this, to me, is one of those sort of silly things that you throw out there for no exact reason. I really believe that we have to look at all the pieces of this and have Congress act. This is a congressional action that needs to be taken, not executive.
Well, and we're hearing there might be compromise. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thank you.
Take care.
A couple of weeks ago, we brought you a story about JBS, a Brazilian meatpacker with a history of deforestation and COVID-19 outbreaks in its plants. Today, we bring you a story of one farmer trying a different way of raising animals for meat consumption. Chris Newman quit his job as a software engineer to start Silfanakwa Farms outside of Washington, D.C., near where Chris's Piscataway ancestors once managed acres of corn and fish along the Potomac River. Chris, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Chris, tell us first a little bit about your farm. What do you grow?
So we mostly consider ourselves land protectors and water protectors first, who happen to grow food. Right now, we are focusing primarily on proteins, pasture-raised chickens, forest-finished pigs, and grass-fed beef, and also pasture-raised eggs. But we're also getting into produce. We're getting into rare seed saving for indigenous varieties of corn, beans, and squash. And we're also looking into reincorporating wilding and foraging into our agricultural systems. So we're a pretty diversified farm, and we're rapidly growing and bringing in more and more people to create a whole food-producing landscape.
This is obviously mission-driven. As you said, you think of yourselves first as land protectors. What was it about this moment that you decided to quit your job as a software engineer to do this work?
The stress of my job in the IT field was causing a lot of health issues for me and a lot of stress for myself and my wife. We were in a situation where I was sleeping in the office and, you know, almost never home and had no work-life balance whatsoever. And in a testament to, the old adage that married men tend to live longer because their wives are smarter than they are, my wife said my tech career was over. And we decided to make a go of it because I literally had nothing to lose.
Yeah, nothing to lose. I want to talk a little bit more about some of what you do on your farm, which is really informed a lot by your ancestors, as you said, knowledge that really can't be found in a book. Share with us a little of what your parents and grandparents passed down that has shaped this worldview.
I come from a mixed background. My mom is Black. My dad is Indigenous in Piscataway Kanoi. And for both of my parents, it was like the arc of progress absolutely went away from the farm. My grandfather on my mom's side definitely dealt with things like, discrimination on the farm, white farmers harvesting his fields last to make sure it was nice and wet, and he'd have to pay drying fees, and people, I don't know, lighting the tractors of his neighbors on fire who would help him out, and just wild stuff that he had to put up with, despite the fact that he was very successful as a farmer in the Virginia Tidewater, growing peanuts and corn and hogs and all kinds of things. And my dad didn't have much in the way of an agricultural background, because with Native people, there's a Native equivalent to the Uncle Tom concept in the African-American community called a hanging around the Fort Indian. And there's a lot of stigma among Native people, especially Native people out west, not so much Native people in the east. But the idea of settling down on a farm and farming a single piece of land is regarded in many communities as a form of surrender. Surrendering your old life ways, surrendering your life of going after game and foraging and managing large landscapes, as opposed to settling down on your 40 acres and hitting that piece of land over and over and over again. There was kind of a lot of cultural baggage to get over when we decided we wanted to come back to the land and try to make a living on it as an expression of independence, as honoring the ancestors who came before my grandparents and tending the soil that we regard as their blood and their bones and as the gifts that they give to us in the form of the things that come out of the ground and nourish us.
Let's talk a little bit more about your particular endeavors. So some food sovereignty spaces believe that large farms are pretty bad. I mean, they have a bad reputation, but you've actually said you need economies of scale in order to be profitable. Are you profitable right now?
We are profitable right now, and we're honestly not even that big. There's a thing I tend to say to people who argue that big is bad. There doesn't have to be a choice between global and Mr. and Mrs. Smith's 15 acres. There's a middle. And when we look at the way that indigenous people, especially indigenous people, have managed landscapes sustainably in the past, prior to contact, prior to the invasion, we manage foodscapes at scale. When you read the firsthand accounts from people like John Smith or Henry Fleet, people that came into my backyard, the things that they described, which they thought was kind of an Edenic paradise just created by God and Indians were plopped down here however many years ago, and that's just the way it was, did not understand that they were riding their chariots and marching through and setting up their settlements in very deliberately cultivated food forests that existed at such a large scale. They didn't realize what they were standing in. They didn't realize that they were basically on a farm. It didn't look like anything they would think of as a food producing landscape. So scale can be a good thing. When we talk about issues with access to food and the farm to table movement and how expensive everything is, and just how out of reach the products are, how out of reach the trade is, because everyone has to come in as an entrepreneur. They have to have access to land and money and everything you would traditionally have to have access to start a business. That's out of range of a lot of people. When you have size, you're able to leverage economies of scale. You're able to leverage more people, get more people involved, have more ownership. This is why we believe in collectivism rather than the farm owner, farm worker relationship. You're able to do things that you just can't do when you're tiny. And you can actually make a difference in terms of ecological restoration. If you're operating on, say, 7,000 or 8,000 acres as opposed to 100, you can actually restore a watershed. You can restore ecosystems at a scale that matters when you're operating at that size.
I want to ask you about some of the now popular messages about food consumption specifically. For instance, don't eat beef or only eat grass-fed beef or only buy organic or avoid GMO. Another argument about all of these messages is that they're classist because they leave out huge swaths of the population that can't afford to eat this way or don't have access to farms like yours. I mean, in an ideal world, what would we be eating year-round, and what mechanisms would there be for people to access it?
I don't think too hard about what people should be eating. There's too much Indian in me to say this is what you should do. That's just not how we operate. That's settler colonial mindset. We have this incredibly schizophrenic food culture where people are always lunging at, what do I buy to solve my problem? And that's just a fundamentally toxic relationship. And I think that these consumerist movements around eat beef, be vegan, you know, all this stuff puts way too much onus on people who are fundamentally becoming desperate because of inequality, because of, you know, slowly eroding democratic norms in the United States. And I think those conscientious consumerist solutions offer kind of an illusion of control that's meant to be a substitute for much deeper and much more complicated problems around how our society is architected and how we as members of society interact with each other and interact with the world around us. And I think farming can do its part, but we have much deeper work to do, and we're seeing some of that work being done now with the aftermath of George Floyd being murdered and all the nationwide and in some cases global protests that we've seen where people have said enough and are understanding that things like racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and all these things at the end of the day come back and they hurt even the privileged members of society eventually. So I think that awakening is happening, and my final thought would be that as sad and as sometimes hopeless as things seem to be now, there are glimmers of hope that I think are more encouraging than anything I've seen in my lifetime.
Chris Newman, founder of Sylvinacqua Farms in the northern neck of Virginia, talking to us about one possible future he sees in farming. We'll have a link to his farm at hereandnow.org. Chris, thank you so much for this conversation.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
As the Wall Street Journal first reported, Twitter may be throwing its hat in the ring to buy the Chinese-owned video-sharing app TikTok. Last week, President Trump issued an executive order to ban TikTok unless it's sold to a U.S. company. So let's check in. What's up with TikTok? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. And Derek, just briefly explain this news about Twitter. You know, they had a video platform. They kind of blew it. And is this purchase likely to happen?
Right. I mean, when it comes to TikTok, the drama is typically on the app. But for the last few weeks, the drama has definitely been the app itself. So most recently, as you alluded to, it's been announced that Twitter's in talks to acquire TikTok. The problem there is that TikTok has been valued at about $50 billion. Twitter's market cap is only $30 billion. So if it is a merger, it's one of the rare mergers where the fish is trying to eat a much bigger fish. That probably means it's going to need some help. And that means, you know, maybe Twitter goes into this deal with a little bit of financing. Maybe they get some kind of loan. Maybe they get some other kind of merger in order to be able to swallow this larger whale. But that is the latest development in this TikTok drama.
Well, and just in case people didn't hear, you said billion with a B, and it's just a reminder that TikTok, its reach is everywhere. In fact, TikTok helps fund NPR-produced videos from Planet Money that appear on the social media platform. A lot of young people reportedly on TikTok were behind those fake purchases of tickets to President Trump's rallies. But what case is Trump making that it should be banned?
So I think it's important to distinguish between two layers of security concerns when it comes to TikTok. The first layer of concern is that companies like TikTok, and this is also true of Facebook, of Twitter, of Google, they collect user data. And there are privacy concerns and sometimes informational disinformation manipulation concerns around companies that have access to data and use algorithms to show people certain videos over other videos or certain posts over other posts. So there's this layer of privacy concerns. But with TikTok, which is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance, there's also the concern that essentially all of this algorithmic information about users all over the world, as you said, are being fed back to the Chinese government, which then can manipulate TikTok the same way that people have accused, say, Facebook of being manipulated by the Trump administration or any other political operation around the world. The problem being that in China, the relationships between the private sector and the government are often a lot tighter than we're used to here in the United States. So what Trump said initially is that he wants to ban the app entirely. It's not entirely clear how he would do that. But more recently, he said he's open to a deal so long as the U.S. government gets a cut of whatever a Microsoft or a Twitter will pay in order to acquire TikTok. It's not entirely clear that that is legal either. So we're just in this limbo here where, you know, we don't know if the administration wants to ban the app or make money off of its sale.
Well, you talk about the security issues. We're seeing reporting that young people on TikTok are increasingly getting behind completely false conspiracy theories like QAnon. U.S. intelligence agencies are saying that China, along with Iran and Russia, would be interfering in the U.S. election, but perhaps on behalf of Joe Biden in China's case. And then you talk about, you know, getting information. If TikTok is purchased by a U.S. company, will that resolve those security concerns?
It does seem like the administration will back off threats to ban the app if a American company like Microsoft or Twitter acquires TikTok and it can guarantee that it's not going to have any relationship going forward with the Chinese government, even though right now its parent company does have tight relationships with the Chinese government. So that should allay concerns. But again, remember how I framed this up top? That really allays the second layer of concerns. It doesn't allay the first layer of concerns, which is that, you know, we've come off several years of trying to think coherently and comprehensively about the way that all of these tech companies insinuate themselves into our lives and use our data combined with their sophisticated algorithms to show us certain things that may or may not be entirely true. So there are a lot of different issues with a company like TikTok, and only one aspect of those issues will firmly be resolved by a sale to an American company.
Well, meanwhile, you know, why would anyone, you know, why would someone want to give a cut to the U.S. government also? But what does it say to us also that TikTok, this Chinese-owned company, has such success in the U.S.?
It's a really, really good question. You know, I think we're used to an idea with it. The United States is the cultural exporter of the world, and that people all across the world, you know, drink Coca-Cola and watch Disney films and use our technology. This is, you know, not the first, clearly, but certainly one of the most significant instances where American teenagers have been devoted to a technological product that is closely associated with the Chinese government. It's a really interesting moment in time, and I think goes to show you how sort of, you know, multipolar this world is. It's another thing to look forward to, I think.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Giving us lots to think about. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.